Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the anime action fan sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your Crown Tom host, Thomas from Tom Mattis, a.k.a. CMJU. And I welcome you to episode 92 of Tom's Prerogative. Yes, we're on the road to 100. Ugh, God, saying that makes me think I now have to pull in Stewie Griffin Brian for a song. But that's not why we're here today. We're here to officially end Disney Month, which has kind of been constantly going on. As you guys know, didn't have anything in February due to computer problems, at least till the very end, and so it started last week of February, and then I put so much on my plate, but I wanted to get to this movie. What movie are we reviewing today that's going to end Disney Month? It's probably one of the most controversial Disney movies of all time. I'm, of course, talking about Walt Disney's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. This is also one of my personal favorite Disney movies of all time. Which, it probably eliminates the fact, some people would say, to review it. But I think it's just so wonderful to discuss what makes this movie good. And at the same time, why this is the movie that really set the downfall for hand-drawn animated films. Or at least was used as an excuse by executives for the downfall of hand-drawn animated films. Because this was really the film that didn't pay off. You know, everybody blames Pocahontas because that was the very first one that didn't make as much as, or more than, I should say, than the last one did. Because when you look at Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and Lion King, they all made, if not just as much, more. I mean, especially Lion King, which was this blockbuster. And then you had Pocahontas, which was a much simpler film. And, I mean, I've reviewed it before. But, you know, didn't have as much money as The Lion King. So everybody blames that. Pocahontas, I don't blame, because I think far too many people blame it. This is the movie, because this was the next big blockbuster. And there are reasons it didn't work. And the great thing to discuss with this movie, as we'll get into, is really what didn't work. People, this is a perfect example, mind you, of what people do. Is how they'll blame certain things. They'll say, oh, this is too dark. Or they'll say things that are really irrelevant to why the film is good or bad. It's more personal opinion of, well, I wouldn't let this person go see it because it has this theme. Or they may not like this. It has no relevancy whether the film is good or not. What hurts the film and what makes people not like it, though, and doesn't make it a good film, is not talked about. And again, we're going to get into it. And it's a pretty obvious thing. Because again, remember one of my sort of gospel truths, as we'll call it, since we're dealing with religion today, is simple. Keep it simple. And sometimes the simple ending, the sort of happy, nice, go lucky ending, is the right ending. You know, I'll sort of lay it down right now. This movie is a perfect example of how a bad ending, kind of like what we saw with Frozen to an extent, though there's a whole lot more things that were wrong with it than this. But in this case, how a bad ending can really hurt a movie, and for that matter, hurt a franchise. I'll let that stew in your mind for a little bit. But that's what we're doing today. I really cannot wait to get right into the review. We do not have any emails or comments. But I think everybody who listens to the show... I mean, I get comments on other shows. I know I have CMG wrestling reviews going. The episode this week will be Spring Stampede, which should be fun. And mind you, I do also want to apologize a little bit for the two-week hiatus. Again, I was going to get to that earlier, but I got into so excited about talking about Hunchback. As I sort of let known, Passover was coming, and I thought, well, the week of Passover, you know, I would have some free time because the preparations for Passover were heavy. But then the week of Passover, I literally was scheduled to work every day that I wasn't at Seder. Like I am this week, and I had school, and I had an essay due, and so things just got in the way. So that's why I've had, unfortunately, this two-week hiatus, and kind of why Disney Month has been basically extended to the end of April. So again, I apologize for that, but with that all being said, let's get right into our review of Walt Disney's The Hunchback of Notre Dame by first going over our synopsis. Our story takes place in 1482 in the great city of Perry. A gypsy with her son is being chased by the evil Judge Frollo for being a gypsy. An unfortunate accident leads to the gypsy woman's death in the flea, and when Frollo picks up her baby, he sees that it is utterly disformed and ugly. And while he goes to kill it, the archdeacon of the church comes out and demands that he protect the child. He then sets the child up in the bell tower of Notre Dame, naming him Quasimodo. 20 years later, Quasimodo has developed into one hell of a bell ringer, and is an innocent man who dreams of going outside, though he is forbidden by his master, Frollo. He sneaks his way to the Festival of Fools, where he happens upon the beautiful gypsy Esmeralda. But when Esmeralda occurs the wrath of Frollo by denying or by disavowing his request to allow the continued torture of Quasimodo, she makes her way to the church where she seeks sanctuary. There she continues to befriend Quasimodo. And with the help of Quasimodo and a fellow friend Phoebus, Quasi helps Esmeralda escape to her people. There, a war is waged between the gypsies, or should I say, a hunt is waged by Frollo to find Esmeralda, who he lusts for, seeking revenge for his embarrassment. Eventually, using Quasi and Phoebus to track down the so-called Court of Miracles, Frollo is able to track down and arrest all the gypsies, including Esmeralda, setting her up to burn for witchcraft. When she rejects one more advance by him, he sets it on fire. But Quasimodo, who had been chained up to the pillars of Notre Dame, is able to break free from his chains and save Esmeralda. Frollo comes to try to bribe the sword and do the deed himself, but Quasimodo and Esmeralda are managed to escape, and in a dazzling event, Frollo is sent off the roof of Notre Dame into the flames below. When they return to the ground, Esmeralda is reunited with her love, Phoebus, and Quasimodo is finally accepted among the people of Perry. Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
city awakes to the bells of Notre Dame. The fisherman fishes, the bakerman bakes to the bells of Notre Dame. To the big bells as loud as the thunder, to the little bells soft as a psalm. And some say the soul of the city is the toll of the bells. The bells of Notre Dame.
This, they're beautiful, no? So many colors of sound, so many changing moods. Because, you know, they don't ring all by themselves.
They don't?
Oh, silly boy. Up there, high, high in the dark bell tower, lives the mysterious bell ringer. Who is this creature?
Who?
What is he?
What?
How did he come to be there?
How?
Hush! And Clopin will tell you. It is a tale of a man and a monster.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it with music. I love the music in this movie. Score and songs. It really does truly continue the tradition. Because regardless of what you think of sort of that, the later half of sort of Disney's golden age, which would be Pocahontas, Hunchback, Hercules, and Mulan, and I guess you throw Tarzan in there, though I think there's like maybe one or two movies before Tarzan, and it kind of, Tarzan fits in with that, those group of films that would ultimately could be, I guess, considered that downfall, and, you know, Tarzan, Journey to Atlantis, Home on the Range, I think is included in there, Treasure Planet, excuse me, not all of which are bad movies, by the way, but again, we're not talking about that, but this is sort of, you know, where you see a rise with Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and Lion King. You see a fall, as I made mention before, with Pocahontas, Hunchback, Hercules, and Mulan. But throughout all these eight movies, the music is, oh my god, gorgeous and beautiful and wonderful. I love it all. Even Hercules, which by far of these eight movies probably has the worst music. But that's kind of like saying, you know, you have three gorgeous women who would win, all of which who would win any, you know, beauty contest they would enter singly if none of the others were there. But when you get all these beautiful women together, there somehow has to be somebody who's in last place. And in this case, it's Hercules with its music. Again, I guess that's a review for next year. But again, it's like, you're saying the worst of the so-called best. You know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. But, yeah, the music and the score, oh my god, this is one of my favorite Disney soundtracks. The more I listen to this soundtrack, the more I fall in love with it. I would have to say this is probably my second favorite Disney soundtrack behind Beauty and the Beast. We'll get into it. I'm probably going to break up, you know, again, that whole list of favorite Disney songs again. Because, again, it's that thing like, oh, I forgot about this song. I forgot about this song. And I'll probably do that again. But, you know, let's start off with the songs. Now, again, the music here, the score and the songs were, well, the score was done by Alan Menken. And the songs were written by Menken and Stefan Schwartz. At the same point in time, I think this was really a tail end of a huge involvement from Alan Menken being in Disney, or at least it should be the start of it. Mostly because, again, his best partner, Howard Ashman, had passed away a couple years ago. And he didn't really have a firm partner. He kept pairing him with other people. And mind you, he still does work for Disney, but again, it never would be as good as before, with the exception of probably this score. His partner in this case, like I said, was Stefan Schwartz, who is another composer who has worked on many. He worked on Pocahontas with Menken, I believe, and you know he actually would also work on the musical Wicked as well. So let's go over the songs one by one. Well, actually, let me rewind that. I'm gonna go over all the good songs one by one. The one bad song I'll leave for the end. So, by process of elimination, you'll probably figure it out by the time I get there. Let's start with the opening piece, Bells of Notre Dame. I mean, oh my god, what a way to open the film. When we talk about music telling story, when we talk about music giving the audience emotion to feel, to be a part of, to make them feel like they are in the film, and to care about characters, in particular the character of Quasimodo. Oh my god, this song is beautiful. It is perfection. Let me say that again. Perfection. It doesn't get more better than this. And mind you, Copeland, who, again, I'm going to say his name again when we go over the cast list before, but Paul Kendall, my god, the most ingenious casting of this movie was him. Because, again, I'll get to how his character speaks and who he reminds me of. I'll probably get to it before time, so forget that. I keep telling you, I'm going to do this. Oh, wait, don't hold me to it. Apparently, I've turned into Chris Christie. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that a low blow? Oh, my God. But no, it's just, oh, my God, how he sings this and how the story is told. And you know how last week with Chris, we talked about, you know, them, you know, sort of stopping song and having these discussions and that didn't work? Here it works. Because, again, you have the song and then you have that middle part in which it's sort of sung, but really not. It is these important story elements that use music to enhance the emotion perfectly. You know, that whole point where the artist's like, you can lie to yourself and your minions. You can tell yourself you haven't a clue. But you can you can never lie to the eyes of Notre Dame. I like blanked on the words for a second. But again, that whole point there, by the way, David Oden Steers, who does the Archdeacon, oh my god, it beautifully does that scene. It, again, another perfect casting. Frollo, perfect. We're gonna get into cast. My god, everything about this song was perfect, and it made you instantly care for the plight of Quasimodo. It told you his backstory. It gave you everything you needed to know. It as an inciting incident. It gave you that backstory, and it helped you understand why you care for him, especially with the actions of him seeming innocent in the scenes to come. It was perfect. Then you have Out There with Quasimodo and Frollo, and again, this great song. I love this song. Again, it just made you care for Quasimodo's character so much. Tom Hoost, who did Quasimodo, I thought he did a great job. I think there are some people, I mean, probably most famously, the Nostalgia Critic, or Doug Walker, I should say, in his Disney December talked about, I think that there was something missing. I really don't think there's something missing. I just think that we want to think that there's something missing. Really, to an extent, it was a beautiful song, and again, it was a great character song. It told that great character story that made us care even more for Quasimodo. Again, I want you to remember this in this review, the caring for Quasimodo, because this is a big point of the big contentious aspect that I'm going to get to when we get to story. So I want you to remember how all this stuff is working towards the caring, for us as an audience to care for Quasimodo. Then you have Topsy Turvy. Oh my god, this is one of those fun Disney songs that are just a romp and a fun, and every lyric is fun. It's like, I guess, Don. Every lyric is a fun romp, and it is just a joy to listen to. And it worked perfectly for that festival scene, so it was a wonderful song. Again, keep looking at his name. Kendall did a great, as Copeland, does a great job singing. He has really three songs, Court of Miracles, which we can get to in a second. Then you've God Help the Outcast, which, let me go. I probably, you'd think I'd have the cast list. Demi Moore did not sing it. Let me get the cast. It was sung by Heidi Mollenher. And I'm probably completely blanking on that name. Unfortunately, I don't have a way to pronounce it. So I apologize for butchering your name. You did a wonderful job in the song. Didn't want to do that. But no, it was just this great thing to where that song is beautiful and telling, you know, again, the story, the plight of Esmeralda, the plight of her people, the plight that they're dealing with in Paris. There's a beautiful thing to where in the middle of the song you have the petitioners who are going up towards sort of the center of the church, and they're praying to God, you know, give me wealth, give me rich, you know, give me love that, you know, I yearn for. And yet she's walking the completely other way, talking about, I don't want anything at all. I just want help for my people. You know, as she's searching for somebody to hear her plight. And again, the imagery, the symbolism in that scene. Oh my God, it's beautiful. Her walking, mind you, apparently, I do believe this is a time where, like, apparently people walking among candles is the popular thing because of Princess Diana's death. Okay, I'm joking about that, but that's the joke that I remember from way back even. It's like, oh wow, she's walking the candles. She must be remembering Princess Diana. Okay, guys, candle in the wind. Let's let it go. But it was a beautiful song. It told Esmeralda's plight. It told the plight of her people. It told the plight as her plight as a leader to an extent. And again, it made you see her as something more than just this beautiful woman. More than just this strong woman who could hold herself. You saw again, we're getting the story here. You saw that strong side before with Topsy Turvy. And that's something I didn't really get into with Topsy Turvy. To an extent, these two songs complement each other because they tell a story of Esmeralda's character. With Topsy Turvy, they show her as a strong, sexy character who's capable of defending herself and basically is a leader. And here they show her as a leader in a different format of somebody yearning, searching for the answers to save her people, who is indomitably emotional about the plight of her people. And it is beautiful. It is gorgeous. Then you have Heaven's Light and Hellfire. Heaven's Light is really sort of this reprieve to an extent that goes into Hellfire with, you know, Quasimodo singing this sort of, really this 4 or 5 verse song about Heaven's Light, how he's not yearned for Heaven's Light, and of course it comes up later in a very important part. That of course leads into the Archdeacon and the monks chanting what's the name? Again, remember, I'm Jewish, so I can't like bring the songs off the top of my head. There is a Mea Culpa. No, that's something he's singing in the song. There's a I know it's a chant. It's a Cantafitor. Again, I'm looking at notes again. I apologize. That's the segue between Heaven's Light and Hellfire. Which, and again, it's beautifully done. Now, because again, what can I say about Hellfire that hasn't been said about perfection? Because that's what it is. It is perfection. It is by far the greatest Disney villain song of all time because it is perfection. It is beautiful. It is gorgeous. It is wonderful. Tony Jaa, oh my God. Sir, you must have been born on this earth just to play this character and just to sing this song. Because, oh my, the imagery, the symbolism is
incredible. It is wonderful. The emotion in this scene. And again, Heaven's Light and Hellfire as complementary pieces of telling a story. Telling, Heaven's Light telling Quasimodo's yearn and being in love with Esmeralda. Hellfire telling Frollo's lust and love for Esmeralda colliding with his beliefs and his yearning to be the so-called judge of, good versus evil, even though he himself is really evil and a sinner. The emotions here are beautiful and gorgeous, and it tells this wonderful story. This is why I get upset about when people talk about the music of Frozen the way they do. It had one really great song that is even on the level of any of these songs, or at least most of the soundtrack. One. The others were okay, and they're okay. From a bar, okay. One really bad one. The others are just kind of okay. But the soundtrack as a whole is nowhere on the level of this soundtrack. It's not Howard Bacon. Just say you want Howard Bacon back. Or Howard Ashman, I'm sorry. I want Howard Macon. That's the tag team of Alan Macon and Howard Ashman. And yes, I want him back too. In fact, I would have loved to see what Alan Macon would have done for the Frozen soundtrack. But with that being said, I mean, the storytelling, it's what I talk about. All these songs are doing exactly what I want to be done in a film. What we look for in film for music to do. They tell a story. They enhance the emotion. They enhance you as an audience caring for the characters. And yet, they don't overpower the story. They don't overpower you with emotion. They're there. They're beautiful. They're memorable. But they're all in conjunction with the story. And that, of course, leads us to the final great song of this soundtrack, Court of Miracles. Again, Copland, I'll say it now and I'll talk about it again, channeling his inner Joker. And oh my god, the funny of this song, I love it, it's everything. And it was a great sort of complimentary piece into what the Court of Miracles are. I was saying, well, this is the Court of Miracles. We have thieves, gypsies, and all this stuff here. And now we have to kill you because you found it. Instead, they have this wonderful little fun romp of a song that I just love, and it's enjoyable. That leads us to the song that, unfortunately, is bad in this soundtrack, A Guy Like You, sung by the Gargoyles. In all due fairness, it's not a bad song. It's a fun song. It's enjoyable. It's the fun little kiddie song that was put in for the kids. Which is the problem. It's the fun kiddie song that was basically put in there for the kids. Now, while other people have said if you just take out that song, Hunchback would be perfect, or almost perfect, I seem to feel like I can argue a different point, and that is that really the problem with the song is that it's in the wrong place. For me, I would take the song and I would put it in between God Help the Outcast and Heaven's Light. In that place of the story. And it's hard because, again, it goes into the story point that I really want to talk about. So I'll definitely bring this up again, this song up again, later when we talk about story. But for me, the two ways you could have done it is, again, he saves Esmeralda, he's going back, and, he says, well, she can never be with a guy like me. And then the Gargoyles sang the song, which then leads into Heaven's Light, because really, Heaven's Light, and of course, the Cantafior Prayer, are really sort of reprieves and can be used as segues into Hellfire. So here you have these three musical elements and three songs that work in conjunction because essentially Guy Like You is telling the same story to an extent of Heaven's Light and Hellfire, at least on an emotional standpoint. And again, it's this great, you go from really light to light to darkening to dark. And again, that contrast of light and darkness, which is would be a perfect moment because, at least a perfect moment for the film, I mean, because the film, if you watch the first half of the film, it's really light. A lot of bright colors, a lot of everything. Again, this is getting the animation. But also the fact that if you look at the second half of the film, it's a whole lot more dark. And so that contrast of light and darkness, and so you get to the second half and it's dark, and again, Hellfire being a representation of the darker mood of that film. And so you have this very light song that's really in the wrong place of the film because it's in the dark place when it should be in the light place. Another way they could do the song is that one aspect I feel that's wrong, and again, it does directly deal with the whole thing that really is wrong with this movie, the flaw, as we should call it, is that one aspect of it is that they don't have as much time as I would like of Esmeralda spending time with Quasimodo as far as in that first meeting. I think they should be like, oh, well, she spent a week with him rather than, oh, it just happened in a day. I think there's it's a time issues, but I think having her basically be there a week would have been better. And again, you could have used this song to tell the story of that week. You know, he's trying to approach her. He has this beautiful woman who he's fallen in love with in the bell tower with him. And then the gargoyles sort of push him in. And while he's doing stuff, ringing bells, lighting candles, helping around with the church with Esmeralda, the gargoyles are singing this little fun sort of almost love song. You know, prodding his confidence to like a guy like you. And I think it would work much better. So while other people argue that the song should be taken out, and I can't deny that's one option, I think it would be much better if the song was really put in a different place. Because that's the real problem of the song. It's in the wrong place of the film. It's towards the end, and it's really only there to set up the scene in which, you know, Esmeralda comes in with Phoebus, lays him down, and kisses him, and like, oh yeah, guy like you, guy, oh, she's kissing him. Well, there's many other fish in the sea, Quasi. I'm kind of giving you clues to what the problem of this film is. I have hoped you've caught on. After these messages, we'll be right back.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I am a terrible geek. I don't watch Doctor Who, I don't care for anime, I've never seen any of the Harry Potter films, much less read the books. I like Star Wars and Star Trek okay, but I've never really ventured far into the extended universes of either property. Hell, I have never even watched a single episode of The Walking Dead. So what do I like?
Comic books.
I've been reading and collecting comic books since 1987, and I've been a fan of superheroes for as long as I can remember. Some would consider this a hobby, but I prefer to look at it as what it truly is, a crippling addiction that I may never recover from. To deal with this borderline personality disorder, I started a podcast in 2007 called
Views from a Long Lost.
Every 2 weeks, or so, depending on real life, I pick a particular series, or issue, or character, or whatever to talk about, and then I talk about them, because that's kind of the point of a podcast. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I have a guest, like my semi-regular co-host, the Irredeemable Shag, or my other semi-regular co-host, Thomas DJ, or with another friend from the podcasting world. The show is located at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com. And from there, you can find the iTunes link, the email address, as well as the backlog of episodes.
Views from the Long Box.
A podcast about comics, or a desperate cry for help? You decide. Every other Tuesday, or so, depending on real life, at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be! It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
Hello, podcast listener. Do you like...
Ready to form Voltron!
Or maybe... How about...
I am Batman!
Or...
This is a job for Superman!
Do you remember...
Power Rangers!
Or this?
Right away, Michael.
Or maybe even this?
Autobots, transform!
Or this?
By the power of Grayskull!
Or...
For the honor of Grayskull!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
Hello, I'm the Doctor.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then check out Charlie's Geekcast, hosted by me, Charlie Niemeyer. Charlie's Geekcast is a bi-weekly podcast covering comics and other geek stuff. The first episode of each month is devoted to comics, where I look at random comics from my collection. The other episode of the month is devoted to whatever else I want to talk about, such as movies, TV shows, cartoons, video games, and more. Feel free to check it out at www.charliesgeekcast.com.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, Dad.
We need to record another new trailer.
Another one?
Yes. You know that we read comics and then talk about comics, because as we've established, talking about comics you've not read is just dumb.
Yeah, and you make me do it every Thursday.
Well, we've moved.
Have we?
Yes, we have outgrown our old location.
I don't feel like I've moved.
And we have now moved to twotruefreaks.com.
What was that again?
Twotruefreaks.com. Hey, Kids Comics, still every Thursday at twotruefreaks.com.
With it, let's move on to the score itself, the actual music. And one thing we didn't talk about is the type of instruments. Again, tambourines, a lot of the instruments, again, they do this very well, the winds, the flutes. And again, the sort of music that was very prevalent of the Renaissance age. Because again, this takes place during the Renaissance, technically. It's 1492... 1482. So, yeah, technically the Renaissance. So, again, the music that you would hear of the Renaissance, the tambourine was very prevalent, a lot of wind instruments, and a lot of sort of flutes, oboes, not a lot of brass, really very little brass, a lot of string. And you know what? The overall score, you know, again, taking music from the songs as well. That whole da 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 da. Oh my God! The grunger. And again, that note tells you right off the bat that this music is good. When I use the word grandeur, because there is grandeur to this film. It is wonderful. It's beautiful. I'm sorry, I said film. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's wonderful. Oh my God. I love it. It does everything a score is supposed to do. Again, you know, it's there. It enhances the emotion. It enhances the story. It gives emotion to the story in the right places. And yet it never overpowers the story. And again, the individual themes that are given to the characters, for the most part, for Quasi and Esmeralda, just, I think, work perfectly for their characters. So, score, it's one of the best, and I know as soon as I get the money, I'm actually going to go out and pick it up. Because the entire score is beautiful. I mean, for the music as whole, with the exception of Guy Like You, the entire score is damn near perfection. And even with Guy Like You, it's not a bad song, it's just put in the wrong place of the movie. So, oh my god, the music is wonderful. With that, let's move on to animation. And with animation, let's talk about the overall style. And again, this great sort of classic Disney style, a lot of soft colors, really taking inference from the Renaissance aspect of it. You know, if you look at the character designs and the animation and the architecture, and again, channeling Disney that they've done, like with Beauty and the Beast and the such, at the same point in time, there's almost a sense of a channeling of that Renaissance architecture, the arches, the gargoyles, that great flair of, you know, the lightness of Renaissance, along with the showing the contrast within the church of the Baroque period. And of course, you know, if it's Baroque, don't fix it. I'm sorry, I could not resist. It's my favorite art joke in the world, because I am a bad, bad person. I am a horrible, terrible person. But yeah, it's just beautiful. The Renaissance, the Baroque period of art. I mean, if you're somebody who knows art and you're looking at it, it's obvious as day. And at the same time, for those who don't know art, it's still gorgeous and beautiful. It leads to great arches and great geometry within the art style. And the character designs are all enhanced by the backgrounds and the overall style. I mean, the overall style is embedded into the characters. All in all, the overall style and the overall decision to sort of channel that Renaissance and Baroque period and that overall time period and that overall art style really paid off in this film. Then you move on to character designs, and I love the character designs. I love Quasimodo character design. Because again, it's not, he's the hunchback, but he doesn't have this like grotesque, like necessary point. He's this big guy, he really looks like he's just hunched over. He looks like somebody who is unfortunately deformed, and yet he's handsome enough to like. And which is a point. You know, even with the original Hunchback and in the sort of most famous one, I believe, of the 1920s movie, there's an element of him that's a bit handsome. And you need that element of sort of handsomeness to, you know, it helps the understanding. I mean, you're not going to put somebody who, with all due respect, and I'm bringing up current events, there was the moment to where the new Pope kissed the man who had that skin disease on his face and looked horrible, and God bless the man. I'm not saying this to be mean about the man, because he obviously has to deal with a horrible, horrible skin disease. But if you had Quasimodo looking like that, the movie wouldn't work. I mean, this is entertainment. This is a fictional world. There has to be a bit of handsomeness there for the movie to work, whether you like that or not. There are people that don't. They want absolute truth, absolute realism. And they just don't get that that just does not work. Because a lot of times that feels like you're shoving political points in people's face. And you don't want. Especially in a movie that's based off a book as controversial and political as this. I mean, the book really is a book about the failure of the church to protect the poor. Which, obviously, the new Pope, by the way, is probably a huge fan of, because he's taken that to heart, at least. Yes, I'm Jewish, and I love the new Pope! But yeah, again, so there's that bit of handsomeness with Quasimodo. I like that it's not just that hunch. Because every time, and this is the other point of it, that anytime anybody does a hunchback character, they always have that big hunch with the point. Here, it's this rounded thing, and his head's a little lower. It's just a great design idea and a great design concept, and made the character different from other so-called hunchbacks. So I loved it for that reason. I thought his color scheme, the green, sort of black and everything, wonderful. Esmeralda, oh my god. Fuck me. Oh my god. Perfection. She is probably in the top three greatest female main character designs ever in Disney. Plain and simple. Up there with Belle. My personal choice as a third would be Aurora. I guess other people's third choice would, I mean, differ. But for the most part, Belle, Esmeralda are the two greatest female designs Disney ever done. And part of it is, for Esmeralda here, is the naturalness of it. The dark skin complements the white and the purple in her clothing. And the hair. And again, God bless them for doing the darker skin color. And again, this is why people get upset about Princess and the Frog. Because like, first black princess. Oh, what about Esmeralda? What about Pocahontas? What about Jasmine? Because to an extent, if you're looking at human characters in Disney film, because you had Lion King before Aladdin and Pocahontas, you technically had three dark-skinned princesses, even though Esmeralda technically isn't a princess. But I thought they always could have said that she's like the princess of the gypsies. In a row, to an extent, which I actually personally like. I thought it was interesting because it presented this... That was truly doing something different. And, by the way, to show you how Disney did it right, they didn't highlight that, they're dark-skinned. Because the point is, there really is no difference between them and the light-skinned princesses like Belle and Ariel and Aurora. That's how Disney should have properly, you know, advertised it, as really, there is no difference. She's dark-skinned, so what? She's a beautiful character. But getting back to it, because I'm getting off track, my god, just perfection. Again, as I said, the skin, in contrast with her clothing, creates a great color scheme that works beautifully. The hair, the curves in her hair, oh my god, are gorgeous. Everything about this character is gorgeous and sexy. And yet, her action animation is wonderful. Oh my god. There's a strength. If you really look at the way they shape her character, there's a core strength to her character design that gives her this strong, this sturdiness, and this maternalness that works in conjunction with the sort of the sexiness and the beautifulness. There's so many layers to this character design. I could stand here all day and talk about it. It is beautiful, it is perfect, and oh my god, I love it. Then you have Phoebus. Phoebus is a great design as that prince character in contrast to Quasimodo as somebody who is competing for the love of Esmeralda. Again, him being a handsome prince. It's not his design, it's the problem. It's the story of it later, as we're going to get to. Again, I'm giving you these clues. Of course, those who are friends, who have heard me talk about this movie, already know this, so don't spoil it for the rest of us. But I think I've pretty much given all the clues I can at this point, and I will continue to. But again, the blondness, the great use of yellow throughout his character design, wonderful. I love the accent of the short hair. To me, that short hair, or at least a male with short hair, to me is something that is precisely Renaissance Paris. Because that's the type of haircut you would see in the Renaissance time in Paris. So that, to me, screams, oh, this is the Renaissance. That's a time denotation there that works wonderfully. And the same thing can be said with Frollo, with his outfit, and oh my god, one of the most perfectly designed villains of all time. The black. I mean, it screams villain at the same point in time. The oldness, the crow lines, and the wrinkles in his skin, the representation of a man who is, you know, stubborn and won't change his ways. All of these characters had symbolism in them. You know, Frollo, with the stubbornness, told you he was a villain, told him his problem, to refuse to accept other people. Phoebus, the shortcut haircut, the yellow and everything, sort of representing a guiding light, being representative of the people, the young people of the time, who are willing to accept different things, who are willing to accept change. Esmeralda and Quasimodo both as sort of angels. The white in their character design, whether it be in clothes or skin color, again, leading to sort of the more angelic aspect as sort of symbols of freedom and things to inspire to be. Again, all that symbolism is perfect and beautiful and wonderful and gorgeous, and I love it. And all the other character designs are great. I mean, Copeland as the jester is wonderful. The soldiers are, you know, even though they really focus on those two soldiers mostly, but all of them really extremely well done. The crowd scenes and everything, extremely well done. Overall, I love the character designs in this movie. Then you have the action animation, and oh my god, I love the action animation. I love the action animation. It is beautiful. It is gorgeous. It is wonderful. I mean, from the topsy-turvy, you know, Festival of Fools scene, to where, you know, all the swinging and everything, and the way everything flows, it's perfect. I mean, the very first scene in the movie, to where you have that chase, I mean, oh my god, the action, the movement of the horse, and the way it flowed, the way they told that scene to get them to Notre Dame, to where, again, the murder of Quasimodo's mother. Oh my god, is that perfect? Not that I'm cheering for the death of somebody, mind you, but the way it was drawn, and the way they did the action, and the way it worked, wonderful. All the action scenes, Phoebus saving the family, extremely well done. And of course, him trying to escape being hit by the arrow. And of course, the finale. Oh my god, the symmetry and the beauty, the use of color in that finale, the black and the red. All the symbol, you know, damnation, despair, hell. I mean, you had hell on earth at the end of that movie. Gorgeous. And, you know, again, Quasimodo, the use of the camera there, showing the swinging of Quasimodo. Oh my god, I love that shot. I love that shot. It is a gorgeous shot. I love the way the camera works in there to tell that story. It is beautiful. I love it, I love it, I love it! Oh my god, I love it. It's just so wonderful to see that. And then in turn, there's really one other action scene. I'm leaving it till we get the story, because it really deals with comedy, because there's a lot of shocking symmetry in this film that I can't believe Disney did. So, just the action animation is gorgeous. And last but not least, the backgrounds and the special effects. I love the backgrounds and the special effects. Oh my god, this is gorgeous. It's beautiful. The backgrounds are... I keep wanting to put Hunchback before I say Notre Dame. But Notre Dame itself, I mean, as a structure, is just beautifully drawn. And the fact that they have this structure, and you think you know every place of it, but then they go in the structure, and there's all these locations that they have inside Notre Dame that are gorgeous. The stained glass windows. And again, the special effects of the light particles, and the rain, and the fire. Oh my god, they are gorgeous. Disney at its best. This is what I go to see a Disney film for. I go to see these type of special effects. I go to see this background. I get to see the symbolism in the art, in the action, in the characters. I go to see the symbolism in the music, and oh my god, I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it. Let me finish this so I can go take a smoke. I mean, and I don't even smoke. The backgrounds are just gorgeous. They're beautiful. They're wonderful. They're Disney at its best. So far, unless you figure out the clues, you have to be wondering what the hell type of problem I have with this movie. Hopefully, we're going to find out in just a moment. As I said, I need a break. I need to take a smoke. I need to relax. I need a new wine. Because Disney just gave me the ride of the life. I'm going to play some promos for you guys. If I haven't creeped you out. Where were we? Oh, yeah. When we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story. So, we'll be right back, folks. So, funny thing happened on the way of recording this episode. After the commercial break that I set in for this episode at this point, I found I went another hour and a half on recording. So I've decided that actually this is not going to be the place for commercials. Instead, this is going to be a nice place to stop as far as a single episode is concerned. And there's going to be a part 2 or part B, as it may be, to this episode, probably within the same length of the show, because most people get the show on the site. So, hopefully. Or for future people with Twitter, it might be with that, or probably be an individual episode. So, of course, remember there are, of course, the numerous ways you can contact the show, the email at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com, the Facebook page, which you can find by searching for Absolution Network on Facebook.com, and, of course, the site itself at www.an.132.com. All the other 132 production contents, Shaft Plus Podcast, Geotaku Momentum, CMG's Wrestling Reviews, Tokyo SOS, Comic Book Crazy, or should I say CMG's Comic Book Crazy, Hexcast, and of course Spectacular Webs, and of course all our friends on the site, so check them out. And we will be back, depending on what you do. Either you can listen to this will be the end, and you'll come back tomorrow and listen to the second, or you may just go and click the, at least how I'm going to have it on the site, the next audio button, and just go right to the second part. But whichever you do, until next time, right? Your new generation.
Find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off, and until we meet again, you know the rest.